Genesis chapter 34. Remember, Jacob, with his 11 sons and one daughter, is back in the promised land. He is meeting with Esau, went very well. They parted again as peaceful brothers. They each went to their own kingdom, though. I use kingdom broadly here, can't really say a household, even though it was a household, because the household was the size of a little kingdom. And so Jacob settles in the promised land, a little area there. He buys a piece of land. And he coexists with a lot of these mega households or little cities that are their own little empires. There's no united government in that area at the time. Things are going well. The nation is growing. There's actually a chance of a nation. He's got 11 sons. The covenant was with Abraham. God renewed again with Jacob. Not full renewal. We'll get to that today. But there was definitely that affirmation at Bethel that God is with him and will be with him now that he's back in the promised land. And he worshipped. Remember? Chapter 33 ends with Jacob doing what Abraham and Isaac had done, and they worship. Chapter 34, verse 1 is a shock to the system. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." You read that and you're almost like, are we even in the right book? This is Genesis. That belongs in Judges, I think. What just happened? We went from Jacob, a patriarch, 11 sons. I know Dinah, the daughter, why is she in the story? Why is she a main character? And then she goes out, we're not quite sure her motives or anything, in any case, she goes out all innocent, perhaps, and then this happens. And it's not just it happened, and what do we do with it? We're getting married now. Well, at least from Shechem's point of view. Why is this story told before we even get to the details? Why, of all the things that happened to Jacob and his family and his sons and his daughters, she did all kinds of stuff, okay? Why is this the only story of Dinah that we know? Why is this so important to have recorded in Scripture? That's not just for shock effect. It is, number one, to warn the Israelites' future, so Mount Sinai and forward, to warn them of the historical effects of considering the ways of the people of the land. Major warning in Deuteronomy and Joshua again. Don't adopt the ways of the Canaanites around you. They don't know God. And here, Dinah goes, presumably innocent. It's not that she's trying to be evil or anything. She's, 11 brothers, okay, you want some female company. Who knows what the motives are? That's not the point here, clearly. She goes to meet the women of the land, other young women. And that act alone results, not in any guilt on her part, results in this horrific experience. She gets raped, humiliated, and then when she realizes again, the prince of the land wants to marry her. The first reason why the story is told is because Israel is going to be tempted to always, they're always going to be tempted to look at the ways of the people of the land, the ways of the people who do not know God. They're always going to be tempted by that. And it's always going to end badly. Remember the innocent time when one of your ancestors tried that and how it ended for her? Don't do that. Second reason it's told is for us, to teach us a lesson on how quickly ruin can come to God's people in this world. Up to now, the story of Jacob, the last little bit at least, was overtly good. He is faithful. He is worshiping. Everything is good. He's in the promised land again. And then Dinah, who in many ways is the least important person connected to Jacob of his family. Daughter, not a son. It's from Leah, not even from from Rachel, and she innocently goes and does something. It's nothing to do with Jacob at all. And yet this happens to her. It's a lesson on how quickly ruin can come to God's people through this world. Of the land here is the Canaanite people and their ways. There's this unfortunate experience then with all its evil, its rape, with violence it seems, and shame. It says he seized her, lay with her, and humiliated her. Okay, the way it's written is to show you just how horrifically evil this is. Then you get in verse 3, this is the only biblical reference that I'm aware of soulmates. So much for that idea. His soul was drawn to her. He considered them soulmates, to use a cliche term of our day. His soul was drawn to her. You're like, this is the most perverted definition of love, and we really belong together. Like, it's so perverse. And yet it's communicated so wonderfully. Hey, my soul was drawn to Dinah. You could imagine Shechem saying that. He loved the young woman, spoke tenderly to her. It's words of love, it's words of tenderness and affection. But it's evil. It's horrifically, horrifically evil. And then Shechem spoke to his father saying, get me this girl, we're going to get married. I fully intend to marry this woman. You have to understand the sin in this verse, the sins in these verses, is not just the rape. There's the rape and its humiliation. There's the violence against women. There's the abuse of power. He's a prince of the land. There's the perverted definition of love from these people of the land who do not know God and His Word. There's tenderness for the sake of brutal selfishness. There's this horrific approach to marriage. Everything is horrifically wrong. So, nation of Israel, when you get to the promised land, do you want to learn the ways of the Canaanites? No, you do not. You most certainly do not. Don't ever forget this story. Application to us, be careful with the ways of the world. It's not as innocent as it might appear. They have got everything wrong. Verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter. As soon as we get back to Jacob, we get back to defiled. Jacob's view of this is right. He does not see this as, oh yes, they definitely have to get married. Okay, this happened and there's obviously love, so let's see what the father wants to say. No, immediately, as soon as you get back to Jacob, you get to objectivity. Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with the livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. That doesn't just mean he waited till nightfall. He probably had to wait a few days. That's entirely possible. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they had heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. But Hamor spoke with him, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us, and the land shall be open to you. You dwell, trade in it, get property in it. Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give it, whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife. You get back to Jacob and his son's focus of the war, what happened, and immediately it's defilement. It's an outrageous thing. Such a thing must not be done. You're immediately back into objectivity. Okay, there is no love here. Everything Shechem had described or was described by Shechem as love and a soul united and wants to get married, that's all perverted versions of it. And then Hamor comes and says, look, this is kind of what's happening. I'm the prince, the king, he's the prince. This is how we do things. We think we can really work together very well. A great way to do it is to become family, so let's do the marriage things both ways. And let's trade in it, let's get property, dwell in it, you're welcome. Okay, this is a major economic alliance that he's proposing. There's no concept in their mind that anything is wrong. It's all just wonderful. This is a great way. It's a good time I came across. My son's sore, and he loves her now, so I think it's going to go really well for us here. Do you see the contrast? You have to sense that I'm being drawn towards seeing some positivity here. There just isn't. There's nothing positive here whatsoever. Talk about righteous indignation. Well, it's not righteous very long, unfortunately. So the brothers... Oh, sorry, I made up my note here. Note this little phrase, a great little phrase, verse 7. The sons came in, there it is, were indignant, very angry, because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel. There's the first use of Israel after the renaming of Jacob to Israel. But here it's not an outrageous thing with Israel's daughter. It says in Israel. It's in the little kingdom of Jacob, Israel. It's a little kingdom. It's just a mega, mega household that's still traveling around a lot and things like that. But yes, it's a cool little phrase there. And immediately, the connection, obviously, to the Israelites into a promised land, all the future generations in the land, struggling with this attraction to the ways of the world. This would really hit home. This was an outrageous thing in our nation, is the way you read it. Not just an outrageous thing in the days of our fathers. This is evil to our nation. Verse 8 to 12, as I say, no mention of sin, merely focusing on what the positive could be of integrating and having some shared purposes and goals and values and things like that. The sons, you can imagine, okay? 11 brothers watching over one sister. The sons of Jacob, verse 13, answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised." Okay, where's this going? "For that would be a disgrace to us." They're very deceitful here, okay? We know they're doing it deceitfully because we're told that. "We can't give our daughter to you in marriage." And you're like, yes, absolutely, never going to happen. "Because you're uncircumcised." Wait, why? Where are we going? That, it would be a disgrace that she marries an uncircumcised man. That would be the disgrace. Like, in any case, they're clever, deceitful. "Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people." Look how they use the same terminology, right? We agree to your deal, there's just one condition. "But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone." So we're going to leave them. Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem, and the young man did not delay to do the thing because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. So presumably the prince in line to become king. "So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city, spoke to the men of the city, saying, 'These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives. Let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men agree to dwell with us to become one people." Again, the term one people. "When every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, they will dwell with us." So there's a bit of a scheming going on that side too, right? Eventually they hope to own everything that is Israel's. verse 24, "And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city." So Hamor gets back to his city. They meet at the courts, or where a lot of the ruling and the legal things would happen, at the city gates. They tell the people of the city, "Look, here's the deal. This is what we need to do." They all agree. They all agree. Notice, though, especially verse 21 again, the phrasing there. The last little bit. "Let us take their daughters as wives. Let us give them our daughters." That's a significant phrase. We've seen it a few times already here. They're talking about intermarriage. Very specifically, their daughters to us, our daughters to them. It's not the men obviously define the nation, but the daughters back and forth. That phrase is a phrase that would ring as an echo in the people of Israel for the rest of the Old Testament. One of the biggest repeated sins of Israel in the rest of the Old Testament is giving their daughters to the nations and taking daughters from the nations for themselves. That terminology is intentionally the same. It doesn't just say intermarry. It specifically uses that picture of giving a daughter and taking somebody else's daughter. And so this is very, very vivid warning for the rest of the Old Testament. The rest of the still future history of Israel as they're reading this at every generation. Under cover of the Abrahamic required covenant and requirement, circumcision, the brothers are convincing Hamor and Shechem to get circumcised as part of a deceitful plan. Now, you don't know what the plan is yet. But they're using the cover of, we are special God's people, and if you want to marry special God's people, then you have to do the sign of the covenant of being in God's people. But it's only external, and there's deceit in it. They're not actually concerned about the spiritual state of Hamor, Shechem, and that city, the Hivites. So the story continues, verse 25. On the third day, when they were sore, so everybody got circumcised, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, so her immediate brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with a sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house. Presumably she'd gone back with him after the negotiations. And went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain, so the rest of the sons came upon the slain, plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field. All their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. Talk about a twist of events. Hamor and Shechem are secretly scheming. Let them do business with us and eventually we'll own everything of theirs. In the meantime, the sons of Jacob are planning to kill everybody, loot everything, so everything from them can be Israel's. Again, you see the twist in the story, right? Why? Why are they doing this? It's very clear. Their motives are incredibly clear. It's because you did an evil thing to Dinah. Very, very clear. Verse 27, because they had defiled their sister. They are very, very clear. Because of what you have done, this is what we are going to do to you. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household. So now you're fearing that everything is going to go back to them. But they said, should he treat our sister like a prostitute? Again, motive is very clear. You remember what happened. And the last verse here is that is a reminder back to his first few verses of what happened. This is revenge. Revenge of the highest order. It's not justice, by the way. What did justice look like in that kind of setting where there's no unified government? Okay, there's all these little cities that are their own little kingdoms. And then you've got these nomadic ones that don't have built cities like Jacob, but they are also incredibly significant, incredibly powerful, often more powerful than the ones in the cities, much wealthier, bigger armies, things like that. But it's all on a kind of mega household scale. What does justice look like? There's no international war court that you can go to and say, what does justice look like? Well, you get a bit of an insight into it from Jacob. Two things from Jacob, and it ties in quite well with this morning's sermon. First is, when he heard the news, he didn't act right away. Okay, he waited. He wanted to consult with his sons. Why did he want to consult with his sons? Well, they were probably in some ways the head of his army too. Okay, he had lots of servants, many of them could bear arms. You see Simeon and Levi, even though they were fighting an incapacitated group of men, they killed them all. So these are significant men. He's going to consult with his army. to see what we do about this. Okay, here's international injustice done. And you get another clue from Jacob that he was thinking about justice, because he says what Simeon and Levi had done wasn't right. He says the communication is not evil happened and justice came. The communication is evil happened and revenge took place. And now they're probably going to get their armies together, and I can fight a lot of them, but when they all get together, they're going to outnumber me. We're going to lose everything. That was foolish. In fact, he ends up fleeing. Well, for more reason than just this. This is not justice. Justice would be Jacob waiting to consult with his army and then attack and bring justice from those in authority. Jacob was not involved in this plan at all. In fact, you get the idea that he was very much kept in the secret and only later found out what they all had schemed and done. All the sons are involved, two leading the pack, Simeon and Levi. And so justice would have been waging war on them, or at least when a negotiation started, Hamor comes with Shechem, they think they've done nothing wrong, it's the way they always do things, to immediately say, no, this was wrong. And we're going to get back to you on this. We're going to get together and we're going to have to make peace or make war. Okay, this is wrong. This has to be avenged without being vengeful. I want to clarify that, especially in light of Ephesians 4, verse 20, what is it, 6 and 7, and Psalm 4. This is not righteous indignation. It starts that way, perhaps. Rightly angry, keeping it in focus the whole time. None of the flattery, none of the love, all of that is perverted. This is an evil moment, not an opportune moment. It's all very clearly because of the gross violation of Dinah. And so Jacob exposes his son's deceit. He exposes the fact that they acted without wisdom and justice, as he was clearly modeling so far, but they acted with brutality. Granted, the outcome of the war with them might have ended the same way, but the method in which it was done was unjust too. Now, before we get to chapter 25, big change of topic. Okay, this is just a chapter. It's just kind of dropped. It's an ugly chapter dropped there between chapters 33 and 35. Here's the application of this, again, to the nation of Israel throughout its history. Would that Israel, the individuals in Israel in the years to come, respond to their hearts wanting to intermarry. As hard as Simeon and Levi responded to Shechem and Hamor, Israel wouldn't have most of its troubles. Okay, this is certainly a warning to what happens if you engage with the world, think you can become one people with the world, and they're certainly always keen to integrate evil with Christianity, right? They always win, and we always end up losing in that deal, as they even intended. There's danger in that. But if Israel recognized, wait, we are sometimes the one who acts like Hamor and Shechem were acting. And if they had gotten as angry with each other as they had gotten angry with Hamor and Shechem, they would have stopped a lot of the sins of the Old Testament. And so there's a lesson of integration with the world, but there's also a lesson with anger and indignation at things that are obviously evil. The response just should have been just rather than revenge. Or if you want to extend application to the sins of Israel doing the same thing in the future, they should have looked at their own hearts before judging others so harshly. And so it's just an odd chapter, but it's not coincidence. It's not just looking for something newsworthy, and obviously this is like mega newsworthy, right? This makes good front page news. It's not in the Bible for shock effect only. It's supposed to have an effect of shock on you. But it's there very strategically to demonstrate how the people of God live in this world, are affected by it, should and should not respond, and how they need to deal with sin righteously angry, but controlled. One of the most repeated phrases of God's indictments against Israel in the future is, she played the whore. The word prostitute. Physical prostitution, spiritual prostitution, they went after other gods, but God uses that same picture even for spiritual idolatry. And that should be such a word picture straight back to Genesis 34. An examination of your own heart. Well, let's get back to how chapter 33 ended. He's in the promised land. God is with him. It's all going well. Obviously, this happened now, so we can't ignore it. Verse 1. God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there." Bethel, very famous by now in our minds. That's where God repeatedly met with Jacob. "Go to Bethel again. Go meet with me there. And dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods." Now, like, we just came out of the dinosaur. Okay? We're going to Bethel. And Jacob turns around and says, "Hey guys, we're going to worship. We should probably get rid of our idols." Why are there idols? Maybe Rachel was after something else when she took those idols after all. "Put away the foreign gods that are among you and purify yourself and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel so that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone." So clearly remembering the significance of Bethel. Remember, God saved me, fled Esau. "I'll go with you when you go. I'll be with you when you come back." When he came back, he came to Bethel, and God says, "I am with you now." Verse 4, "So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had and the rings that were in their ears." Presumably that was related to false worship, like little charms and things like that. "Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem." Shechem, the town, not the person who's dead. "And as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz," that is Bethel, "which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. There he built an altar and called the place El Bethel," so God Bethel, "because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried under an oak below Bethel, so he called its name Alon Bakuth." Jacob flees in light of the fear of other nations coming after him for Simeon and Levi's behavior, but also for the purpose of worship. This is God, in many ways, restoring the glory and purity of Israel. And so God is going to act after the defilement with Dinah, and he's going to purify themselves. And you see some purification even happening within Israel now, as Jacob says, "We need to get rid of all these false gods." That's presumably, maybe not his family, but at least his servants were obviously worshiping. We get the emphasis again that God is with Jacob, as we see every time that Bethel comes up. All things idolatrous are left behind, the idols, the charms, everything are buried under a tree there. And then you get this comment in verse 5 of this divine protection. Isn't that amazing? "As they journeyed," and remember, you're still fearful that people are coming to avenge Amar and Shechem's death. "A terror from God fell upon the cities that were around." I have no idea what that even looks like. "A terror of God fell upon them." Like, for some reason, everybody in the city was terrified at the God of Jacob when he pitched, starts folding up his tents and getting all his herds together again, saying, "We're going to travel." Everybody's like, "Don't you dare touch him. I don't know why we're terrified of this guy, but for now, stay far away from him." Something like that. We don't know exactly. There's divine protection. Do you see that? God is with them. Bethel's in our minds again, but there's this terror that's living. You're not sure what the outcome is going to be, and you realize that story's done. We're done with that story. We're purifying again. God is with us. God is protecting us. Don't fear anything from that story. We're done with that story. Like I say, chapter 34 is literally just going to drop there on its own in the middle of chapter 33 and 35. But here's a little clue to us that we can move on from that street. And then you get to the arrival at Bethel, significant in Jacob's life as far as God's promises to him. And there he worships. And he builds an altar and he worships again. And he calls the name El Bethel, so adds God to the name that's already about God. Then this takes place. Verse 9. God appeared to Jacob again when he had come from Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. So this is the more formal version of what happened at Bethel last time. And God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply." I love that. Like, I am God, and you've got a nation to build. Get going. And God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give their land to your offspring after you. Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him, and Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, and poured out a drink offering on it, and poured oil on it. So Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken with him, Bethel. In case you missed that in all other Bethel references. Formal renewal of the Abrahamic covenant is what's happening. God blesses Jacob very clearly. He confirms the renaming of Jacob to Israel, the national name, and the nation is the focus here. You're still in the promised land. Bethel's in the land of Canaan, the promised land. You're still in the promised land, but we're going to emphasize the nation that is coming from you. There's going to be a nation. So first of all, be fruitful and multiply. Okay, I know you've got 11 sons, but keep going. And the implications, obviously, for his descendants then. A nation, a company of nations is going to come from you. It's going to be a big deal. There's even reference to a king. Kings shall come from your own body. One day, you're going to have a nation that's going to be like a real nation. It's going to have a kingdom with a king appointed over it. Kings are, the whole dynasty is going to come from you. Verse 12, he confirms the land. So you've got the blessing, similar to the Abrahamic covenant's details. You've got the nation, the descendants. King is even added here. And you've got the land mentioned. I will give it to you. I gave it the promise to I gave the land to Abraham and Isaac already, and I will keep giving it to you. One day you're actually going to possess the land that is already theirs. And then verse 13 makes you realize when it says God met with him, God appeared to Jacob again, verse 9, that's a physical in-person appearance. Because God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him. So God left, moved on, presumably straight up, but it could just mean he moved on further, left. And Jacob sets a pillar there saying, this is where I met with God again. And so the place is called Bethel, because that's where he strove, wrestled with God. Remember all those parts. In-person meeting with God. The drink offering is significant because it's not just an expression of worship, but it's one of the more expressive expressions of worship in the sacrificial practices of the day. It had a bit of a more glory and glow to it. Okay, it's like if you're making a bonfire and throw petrol on it. Okay, it's just the nicer version, the more fun version. You see the expression of devotion. It's not minimalistic worship. This is wholehearted worship. Jacob is incredibly devoted to the Lord and grateful for everything that God has done for him. This is Jacob's favorite spot, Bethel, where God deals with him according to his own promise. It's great joy in the Lord, devotion. And so the Abrahamic covenant is clearly confirmed to the third generation of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we know the way forward. Now we're waiting for a lot of multiplication happening till we are a nation. And so in many ways, since we know the end of the story already, we see now that the transition is taking place here. From now on, we're just waiting for the people to become a lot. And so since you know they end up in Egypt, you're waiting for something like that, where they can just become a really large number of people. And Exodus starts that way, right? They were a really large number of people. So large that it threatened the economy of a world power, Egypt. What do we do, though, combining this to chapter 34? What's the lesson of chapter 34, verse 1 to 25, verse 15? It's maybe an odd place to break it, but I wanted to put them together. Though, perhaps through innocence, perhaps through curiosity with Dinah, perhaps through compromise, we have no idea what her motives were. Whether it is through innocence or just curiosity of the world or perhaps compromise with the world, great sin can come to God's people from those who are not part of God's people. Great sin can come to God's people from those who are not part of God's people, especially when there's too much interaction going on. We don't have to judge Dinah's motives, But in motives, that there's a desire to integrate with the world, and kind of mix our philosophies a little bit, and work together, and be one people, and not always be so judgmental, and things like that. Be very, very, very careful. Their goal is to eventually have everything of you. Your goal is to eventually convert them, and it always works the other way, okay? It never ends well. It didn't end well here at all. Jacob had to leave. And yet, God rescues his own from the horror of sins committed against them. He confirms his presence and promises, and they worship him with great devotion. I remember that, especially, I'm going to extend the application a little far, but I remember that when you're dealing with Christians who are overcome by horrific sin done against them, you can turn to something like this and show how God did not hold that against them. God did not hold Dinah and what happened to her, the sins of Shechem and Hamor, didn't hold that against the people of Israel, even though Dinah was the one who was defiled and shamed by it all. God renewed his covenant with them. God said, I promise to bless you and I'll be with you. My presence is going to stay with you and you can worship. You can worship fully and purely. It's a bit of an extended application, but let's not forget that. Back to the main point. Do not underestimate the integration, especially on sexual matters, with the world. It always ends badly. Do not avenge yourself. There's a godly way to do it. And trust God's blessing, God's promises, God's presence. Worship holy and purely. That was the lesson for Israel, listening to this. That's certainly the lesson for us too, isn't it? Questions or comments on this? A few minutes. Natasha.
The parallel contrast that Abraham with Genesis 34
and Numbers 25. Yes. So Genesis 34 and Numbers 25, there's a bit of a parallel there, okay? It's the other way around. So Numbers 25 is the nation of Israel going and committing this kind of sexual immorality and compromise. And there it ended very justly with Phinehas, obviously. Here there's a mixture of right indignation and severe evil, worldly anger. But there's a striking parallel there, absolutely.
And just like it stops with saying, like, the Israelites poured after
the Lord. Yes.
Good. A lot of the parallels, but then also strong contrast.
Yes, a lot of parallels, a lot of contrast. And you can trace the parallels to Genesis 34. And the rest of Israel's history, you can trace a lot of those historical events back to the events of Genesis 34 and get insight and instruction from Genesis 34. You read this and you're like, okay, we're done with that chapter. Well, no, you're forced to think of that chapter many, many, many times in the rest of the Old Testament. It's profoundly instructional, valuable for training. So the question is, when the brothers, Simeon and Levi, killed everybody, then the brothers came and looted everything, including the women and children, right? Now that was a common practice of war, and they would become the servants then. And so this was a significant expansion to Jacob's little empire. So that's typically what would happen. When we read about the gods who were there, where was that? Yes. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods. So the likelihood is that those women came and children came with their own gods. That's entirely possible. But the emphasis in verse 2 is clearly Jacob saying it to his household too. And we already have the Rachel story of stealing her father's gods. And so we can't just blame the entrance of foreign gods into Jacob's world on these women and children that were taken in war. It's the household is guilty too. But then the question was also, was it even right for them to take the women and children? Well, it wasn't right for them to kill all the people in that way. If they had done it the right way, and let's say there was a war, and it ended up being just a physical battle between them because of seeking justice for what happened to Dinah, then they would have ended up taking all the women and children, and that was an accepted practice, and Scripture doesn't tell us at all that it's not right. And they would just become the servants, okay? They would fall under the care and rule and authority of Jacob. And so, whether slaves or servants, it's irrelevant even, because Jacob would have to provide for them and care for them, and they would serve him. And so that's, this text certainly doesn't make a judgment call on that. But even from the rest of Scripture, that's not necessarily something we need to condemn or approve. We can stay neutral on it and focus on the point of the story.
Is Bethel today's Bethlehem?
No. Bethel is not today's Bethlehem. Bethel is much more north up on the promised land. I can't picture it exactly now. Look at a map. But it's not Bethlehem. In fact, Bethlehem shows up in the next story, I think. Yes. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we are grateful to your faithfulness. We are grateful that in many ways your promises that you have made to your people, be it Israel in the Old Testament or us today, the promises you've made to your people are in no way affected by the sin done against your people by this evil world. And we thank you for that. You are indeed our stronghold, our refuge. No matter what happens to us, we know we are always safe with you. We can worship you. Your presence will always be with us, and you will avenge all wrongs. Lord, thank you for these lessons. Thank you for these instructions. Teach us to learn from them, to examine our own hearts and not fall in the same sins as those who have gone before us have done. Keep us holy, keep us pure and blameless. May we live holy, set apart from this world, even though we're in this world. And may they see us as light and salt, and not as those who can be exploited and be united with to eventually be destroyed. So grant us conviction, clarity of Christian conviction. Grant us that for Christ's sake.